And in the studio, fantastic quality quartet, Charles Ather, solicitor extraordinaire. Is that fair enough, solicitor extraordinaire, Charles?
No, it's not. No. Oh, I don't accept extraordinaire. No.
Okay.
So,
average, slightly better than average.
Slightly better than average. That's okay. I don't think we've got the Law Society on the line at present, Charles. Just to see, we're working through that. Has been known. Of course, Jill Prowse from Revenue and Customs.
Hello there.
Always keeping us appraised of what's going on and all the rest of the bits and pieces. Jill Appleton, Book of the Month host and coordinator and intrinsic part of Middlesbrough Book Festival, obviously together with Sarah, Dennis and the rest of the team, and of course Middlesbrough Library Services.
Yep.
And Rob Nichols, of course, Fly Me to the Moon editor. And also somebody who's actually just drawn a nice link between our next telephonic co-presenter, a gentleman who's regularly on every Thursday morning with me on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. That's Ace Film critic, royal correspondent and former international editor of international Who's Who magazine. As I say, it's only a matter of time before it's Sir Robert Nichols and indeed Lord Charles Ather. Exactly. It's definite, though. We work on that. We have the fantastic Richard Fitzwilliams. How are you, Richard?
Very well indeed. Looking forward to the Oscars.
Yeah, well, this is it. I mean, we'll talk about that. But anyway, I want to talk a little bit to start off with today, Richard, about your connection with the Meteor and the Bounty, because, Robert, you said there's a nice link here with, of course, Middlesbrough and James Cook.
Well, we're in James Cook Hospital, and, of course, Bligh was taught everything he knew about navigational skills from Captain Cook, and, of course, he did that. And the other side of the Bounty, isn't it, is the incredible navigational feats that, that Bligh did in getting that the boat back to safety, which was absolutely incredible, with just the book and to look at the stars to sort of navigate by.
Oh, it's an extraordinary story, this, yes. Because, of course, Bligh, at the age of 22, was absolutely thrilled to be sailing master to Captain Cook on his third voyage. Cook, of course, was iconic at that time. His first two voyages had been extraordinary feats of navigation, and he, of course, was so well known for his humanity and his determination to drive out scurvy and so forth. Of course, by the third voyage, it's absolutely true that Cook was the mentor of Bligh, you could say. But by the third voyage, Captain Cook was ill. He was often subject to fits of temper and often extremely cruel, and you could argue that Bligh, who was basically extremely humane, although very tempestuous, was very much influenced by Cook. Interesting, of course, after Cook was tragically killed on Hawaii, it was Bligh who brought the Resolution and the Discovery back to England, and he should have got a good deal more credit for it than he actually did. Bligh, of course, was middle class and not aristocratic, something that counted against him. Yes, you're right also about Bligh's epic open boat voyage, 47 days, 3,618 miles from where he was cast adrift by Christian and the mutineers to the Dutch settlement of Timor, and losing only one man. It's an unparalleled feat in naval navigation.
And I was thinking, Charles, actually, when you were sailing around the Cape of Good Hope a wee while ago, it was prodigious. It's obviously sort of setting the scene in many ways for
Cape of Good Hope.
Good Hope. Yes. Research has all let us down from that point of view.
But did Bligh actually know where he was going, or did he just sort of get lucky and hit land?
Oh, Bligh navigated from memory because he'd been in those waters a decade earlier with Captain Cook. But the amazing thing about the open boat voyage was that he kept his log and logged discoveries such as the Fiji Islands.
Mm.
I mean, this was an extraordinary achievement because everyone must have thought that they were going to their death. A 23-foot longboat with provisions for 11 days, and Bligh stretched it up to 47.
Mm.
I mean, it was amazing. It also ought to be said in balance that it was his temper and also the grave mistake reaching Tahiti when he did in October of 1788. It was the wrong period for the transportation for the plants because, of course, the purpose of the voyage was to take breadfruit from Tahiti to Jamaica, and they had to wait 5 months. He also had to do some charting of the Endeavour Straits and needed the winds. And it was during those 5 months Bligh made a bad mistake and let the men slack, and the officers too, then trying to reimpose discipline.
It's not good. I find that every time I do one of these radio shows, Richard, you know that if you let the team slack and you don't have that discipline, chaos, anarchy.
Absolutely, and then you delegate to your officers. But of course, Bligh could delegate, but it's your responsibility, and it was Bligh's responsibility. He conceived the Bounty voyage because he was a deeply humane man. No question about it. He took so much care of his men's health following Cook. He conceived it as a possible perfect voyage, but one of the difficulties was that he had tunnel vision. He could never, as a perfectionist, imagine that he could make a mistake. And no one was more surprised than him that Christian, at the end of his tether, after being cursed for a very considerable period of time, and being undoubtedly extremely sensitive, burst into his cabin at 4 o'clock in the morning with three of the mutineers. They had very little trouble actually taking the ship. Bligh, as we saw in some of the cinematic recreations, particularly the Charles Lawton Clark Gable one, which bears no resemblance to history, but it's an extremely colourful film, gave vent to his fury for 3 hours shouting himself hoarse. Not that it did him much good.
And your own family connection with this whole event, Richard?
His, through my great-great-grandmother, her grandfather's niece, Betsy Elizabeth Beetham, the daughter of the receiver of customs on the Isle of Man, married Bligh in 1781, and it was a very happy marriage. Betsy, as she was known, and Sir Joseph Banks, who was the president of the Royal Society, were the only two supporters of Bligh throughout his eventful and extremely turbulent life, because although he was undoubtedly a navigational genius and a remarkable seaman, and was most distinguished too at the battles of Camperdown, and particularly that of Copenhagen, he was able, by his force of temper, even in the 18th century, to antagonize so many people. And the other problem was, of course, he wasn't upper class, he was middle class.
Oh, well, and say no more. That's
a great difficulty at the time, because if you antagonized the Christians and also the Haywards, because young Peter Hayward was, according to Bligh, a mutineer, and you're out of the country, which Bligh was during the trial of the mutineers, you have serious problems. And Christian's brother Edward, a brilliant barrister, conducted a superlative propaganda campaign against Bligh, and look how successful it's been. If you go into the street and mention mutineer and the Bounty, anyone knowing about it will think of tyrannical, monstrous captain, dashing aristocratic first mate, and possibly something about a superb open boat voyage, and of course the discovery of Pitcairn.
What actually happened to the mutineers in the end of the day?
Well, it was interesting, this. A series of things. Firstly, on those left on Tahiti who didn't go with Christian to Pitcairn, they were taken back to England by the real monster, the real vicious creature who commanded HMS Pandora, who was sent to bring the mutineers to justice, Captain Edward Edwards. Four of them drowned. Three were hung after the trial. One got off on a technicality. Two, one Peter Haywood, who's buried in Highgate near here, and the other James Morrison, who wrote a very, very colourful account, the boatswain's mate. They were found guilty of a pardon by the king. Edward Edwards was dreadful, an abomination. He was notorious for his treatment of prisoners. And four, one loyalist, because not everyone could get in Bligh's open boat, and three mutineers went down in the Pandora when it struck a reef. But eight went with Christian to Pitcairn, together with six Tahitians. All the mutineers had female partners. That six Tahitians shared three women. It was when one of the mutineers' women died, and the mutineers made the mistake of treating the Tahitians as slaves, interracial strife and warfare meant that within 3 years, all but four of the mutineers and all the Tahitians were dead, including Christian, unless you believe the reports that he returned to England, which aren't substantiated.
radio on the programme today, we've actually gone seamlessly, it would seem, from corruption in football, losing £124 million, etc., through to Tahitians, interracial marriages and Captain Bligh's mutiny on the Bounty.
Which I can imagine that precisely that must have occurred. But in fact, one of the interesting things about mutiny on the Bounty is that practically everyone's heard of it. There's been nothing quite like it. I mean, the clash of temperament between William Bligh at 34 and Fletcher Christian at 23, the fact that it was on the high seas and the Admiralty never allowed mutiny, it ruthlessly hunted down anyone responsible. The fact that it was linked with Tahiti, only discovered 20 years prior to that by European ships, so it was a paradise on earth, and with the open boat voyage and the discovery of Pitcairn. The great David Lean intended to make a film in it, was backed by Dino De Laurentiis, went to the South Seas, then determined to make two films, lost all his backing. His screenwriter, Robert Bolt, Man for All Seasons, Lawrence of Arabia, had a heart attack tragically. And the film was made finally by Roger Donaldson with Anthony Hopkins as Bligh and Mel Gibson as Christian, and lacked the authenticity of Master and Commander, or even though it was more historically accurate, which wouldn't be difficult, than the first two films.
I don't know, Jill. I mean, I think you should seriously look at inviting Richard up to talk about the Mutiny and the Bounty in various ways. For throw that in there. So it's thumbs up on that basis. Mm-hmm. It was the James Cook connection. However, that wasn't really what we wanted to speak about at all in many ways, Richard. We wanted to briefly talk about, in this Diamond Jubilee new programme, a new series we're putting together. I often refer to Charles Arthur as a bit like the kind of sponsor of Caravaggio, all sorts of things that we're working through this, the kind of the mentor that sort of leads into all sorts of other bits and pieces. It's splendid. Because I know we've just started this thing, kicked off with the Actors' Church in London, and ahead of the Diamond Jubilee, we're going to be having a look at St. Paul's Cathedral in a few moments, a new sort of area through that whole perspective. But would you like to just explain to our listener and the team here, why is it you're pretty much the go-to person for royal issues, royal correspondence from CNN to indeed Al Jazeera?
Well, I think the reason probably is that, firstly, being brought up in South Africa, my parents were always extremely interested in royal matters, and I had a picture of the Queen saluting on Burmese and trooping the colour above my bed, and was always interested in the royal issues. I became editor of International Who's Who in 1975, and then was that for 26 years, and that had a special section on the royals. So I used to follow what they did and occasionally commentate, and then when I left International Who's Who, branching out, public relations, of course, with including the Royal Society of Portrait Painters and Threadneedle Prize, but also the royals and the movies seemed to be the places it was most logical for me to progress as a commentator. And studying royal issues, and whether you attend Trooping the Colour or Royal Ascot, as I have for many years, or occasionally the magnificent Garter ceremony at Windsor, and also on occasion royal collection exhibitions at Buckingham Palace, and most recently an absolutely wonderful occasion, the Diamond Jubilee media reception, one of the themed receptions.
I was going to actually just launch onto that one, basically, because I mean I was shocked to find that neither Jill Appleton nor indeed Jill Prowse, you didn't receive your Southside interviews to actually go to the Diamond Jubilee Press Buckingham Palace.
Very disappointed, Alex.
I thought you might have been, exactly. So what did they miss, Richard?
Well, it was a truly magnificent occasion. There were some 300 of us, and greeted by the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh, and then as you move around and meet others, so members of the royal family move around and chat to the various journalists.
They move amongst the press. Unbelievable.
Well, it was certainly a wonderful occasion. I suspect, looking around at some of the faces, from Simon Scammer to David Starkey, and from Andrew Neil to Eamon Holmes, and you name it, the various editors were there. I think it was one of the most significant gatherings of the press that had been held in London. I knew so many faces, and it was absolutely fascinating and absolutely wonderful, I have to say, to To meet the Queen, too.
Charles, we were talking earlier about this pre-show, in our usual pre-show warm-up, where we usually have the sort of the brisk rub-down and the sort of general motivation, we're going to do the best radio show ever, that kind of motivation set up here. And I think we were both agreed that actually the Royals, they're an essential part of what we're about. And I think, as you say, not necessarily a fan, but you appreciate the good work that they actually put together.
Yes, I do. I think it's a bit going over the top saying it's a wonderful occasion. How could it be a wonderful occasion with a load of press editors and a few Royals? Well, what's
Rupert wonderful? Murdoch might be having a wonderful occasion at this moment with the Sun.
How could that be wonderful?
Firstly, back in Buckingham Palace itself, there is a certain cachet. I mean, whether you regard the press as wonderful or not, I mean, depending on the individuals concerned, and of course a lot of them are television personalities too, and some historians that I mentioned. But in the magnificent environs of Buckingham Palace, that I do believe that although some daylight has certainly been let in on magic, occupied palace, like Buckingham Palace, a working palace, has an important cachet. You go to the Pitti Palace or you go to Versailles and, you know, it's pretty empty. Whereas when it's, as Buckingham Palace is, and on that sort of occasion, the way they handle it, it is spectacular, it is very grand.
I've often felt, Richard, that, you know, were we to actually move our studios from either the University of Lincoln or the James Cook University Hospital, then Buckingham Palace would be a logical place for Southside Broadcasting and Siren FM to sort of base itself, but you know, clearly that's open to negotiation, really.
I would have thought it would have been.
I'm sure it's a wonderful location.
But somebody who promotes art exhibitions, going to the Royal Collection previews, that too is absolutely fascinating because they have a complete mix. I was very surprised. Victoria and Albert one, the exhibition they had last year, did brilliantly. It was not an exhibition I would have thought would have had wide appeal because Victoria and Albert have, well, obviously limited appeal given Victoria, the image of Victoria as a rather dumpy widow wearing.
And Prince Albert as a German, say no more.
But, a hard working one, I think most people
would have liked it. And he brought the Christmas tree over, so, you know, it's not all bad from that perspective.
Consider the amazing difference between a queen at 85, able to do what she still is, and with such style. Look at the visit to Ireland, for example, just as one brilliant example of this, and Queen Victoria at her Diamond Jubilee, I mean, impressive indeed, but too frail to enter St. Paul's, so of course the services, we all know, came to her on the steps. But no question, I think, we're blessed to have the Queen and Prince Philip, 185, the other 90, doing what they're doing.
How do you think William's going to do?
He's
going to be a bit of a breath of fresh air, isn't he?
Well, the idea of William the reluctant royal, all of this was press speculation in early years. He's just as dedicated as his grandmother, I suspect, and he's got charm and seems to me untouched by trauma, and also, of course, as we all know, he has a beautiful wife who's a fashion icon already.
And loved by the people of Liverpool, so what's more to say? I mean, at least that's a step forward than Mrs. Thatcher ever had, but never mind. On to Jill Appleton. Any quick questions for yourself to wrap up with Richard Fitzwilliams at present?
I was quite interested in this international who's who. What do I have to do to get in there, then?
Why aren't I in it?
Yeah.
Many are called and few are chosen.
Oh.
20,000 were chosen for the international who's who, about 1,000 new entries each year, the dead and some 700 cut out. And what you had to do, Prime Minister, President, Nobel Prize winner, permanent representative to the United Nations, win an Oscar, do something truly dramatic, a merit which is sustained in a particular field, to get you into international celebrity, because this was different to the British Who's Who, which is edited by an anonymous woman. I was certain.
Well, say no more then.
Well, the last editor that we know that edited Who's Who was Douglas Leyden, who was fired in 1899. Subsequent to that, we don't know the name.
Could be out there now, just taking notes.
They are. I've met the editor of Who's Who, but my lips are...
No, it's all right. It's okay, Richard. We're not going to press you on that one, and we wouldn't expect nothing else. It's been a fabulous connection. We haven't even talked about what we'll be doing in a couple of weeks' time with St. Paul's, but we will go on to that at another sort of time. It's nothing serious, by the way, dear listener. We're not going there to case the joint or anything else. It's going to be sort of seeing a whole range of other bits and pieces.
And it'll be the setting, of course, for the service of Thanksgiving for the Diamond Jubilee, which... I mean, I was watching, again, just a few days ago, the Golden Jubilee service of Thanksgiving there. Absolutely magnificent. And what a show it will be. And then there's the River Pageant. So much to look forward to.
And Elton John performing as well. There's nothing else you can actually say after that.
The Queen in a barge.
Richard, have you had a reasonably interesting... It's not like chicken in a bun, Charles.
Well,
at least.
You know, the Queen on a barge just doesn't do
you
it for
you
me.
You don't think the Queen on a barge is... No. Right.
You don't think the barge she sat in like a burnished throne...
Well, she's not Cleopatra,
water.
Is she? You know.
It's an interesting line.
Yeah. Purple the sails and so perfumed the
But we're back to water again, back to Mutiny on the Bounty.
Age shall not wither her, nor custom stale her infinite variety. How about that?
Other women cloy the appetites they feed, but she makes hungry where most she satisfies.
Absolutely.
We are such stuff as dreams are made of. Richard, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
I've had an extremely interesting one.
And we look forward to, again, featuring yourself on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition on Siren in the very near future. In fact, specifically next Thursday, probably around about 8:10 in the morning. So there you go, sirenonline.co.uk. That's all you need to click on to listen live to that, or listen to the podcasts. They're always fun, aren't they?
They most certainly are.
Thank you, Richard. We'll salute you. Take care now.
It's a pleasure.